It was in the great cities of Mesopotamia, Uruk, Assur, and famously Babylon, that 10,000 years ago human civilization and progress took off. Humans inaugurated urban culture. It would later be exemplified in the great Italian cities of Florence, Bologna, Siena, and Milan that nurtured the Renaissance. Human beings in close urban association have always sparked off each other in workplaces and the many social nooks and crannies of a city, making friends, creating ideas, art, technology, and finding purpose. Today, over 55% of the global population lives in cities, set to rise to only 70% by 2050. In Britain, already close to 85% of us live in cities. But do we give enough thought to ensuring these wonderful potential benefits of cities work for everyone who lives in them? To build cities that are truly inclusive, we need to reimagine urban space, not just in terms of functionality, but as places where people of all ages can participate fully in public, work, and social life. That is about better design and planning, certainly, but above all, processes that listen to and reflect the needs of everyone in the community, from the youngest to the oldest. Joining us are two leading voices in this field. Professor Tina Buffel is Professor of Sociology and Social Gerontology at the University of Manchester, where she directs the Manchester Urban Ageing Research Group. Her research focuses on neighbourhood and community life in later life, social inequality and exclusion, urban deprivation, and developing age-friendly environments. She works closely with older people to co-produce solutions that make neighbourhoods more inclusive, connective, and supportive as we grow older. Also with us is Dr. Julia King, architect and urban researcher, whose work focuses on designing cities that are more inclusive, especially for those often left out of mainstream planning, such as girls and young women. Her work at the LSE resulted in the design, development, and realization of several public space projects. Julia advocates for participatory, socially engaged approaches that focus on the lived experience of marginalized groups, working to create spaces that are safer, more welcoming, and more equitable for everyone. Welcome to you both. Tina, just introduce yourself and also address how well designed our cities in the UK for older people.
Thanks for that. So I am Tina Buffel, and I'm a sociologist and a social gerontologist. And what that means is that I'm very interested in studying aging as a fundamentally social process. So not just as a health issue, but trying to understand how communities, how policies, how relationships and how our environments are shaping the way in which we grow older. And one of the core issues is that cities were never really designed with aging in mind, and they still aren't, which is surprising given that the vast majority of older people, around 3 in 4 people in England and Wales, actually live in urban areas. And if you think about it, cities should actually be the best places to grow older, with shops and services and green spaces, transportations, opportunities for socialization, all on our doorstep. But our research in Greater Manchester, but also internationally, shows that urban environments often exclude older people. And sometimes the barriers are physical. So many older people tell us that bus stops are too far away from their homes. There's a lack of seating or public toilets, unsafe crossings. Sometimes signage can be hard to navigate. But the barriers are also social. And what is really telling here is that we've had a decade of austerity that has stripped away much of the social infrastructure many older people rely on, including losses of libraries, lunching clubs, community transport, all of which has kind of deepened a sense of exclusion, which we find is especially high amongst marginalized groups who often faced the deepest cuts in public funding. But of course, this isn't just about aging. It's about who our cities are built for.
Now, Julia, I'm just going to bring you in here because I want to pull you into the conversation. You know, just because your work focuses on younger folk and girls and women in particular, young women in particular. And I'm guessing as you hear Tina, you're kind of nodding and thinking that refracts in my work as well. So over to you.
Yeah, I was definitely nodding along as Tina was talking because so I also have a background in academia, but I've left recently and to set up a company called Social Place, where we work with communities to connect them to development and planning, and often through paid placements. And most of the people we work with are young people, and often young women and girls and young gender diverse young people. And the context that we're working in, just to add to the litany of the loss of social infrastructure in this country, is a huge decline in youth provision. So that's the context that we're working in. And what we can see, what we've seen, is a sort of 50% reduction in youth spaces.
A 50% reduction in youth spaces. Since when?
Since 2010, so since austerity began. And there's ripple effects around that, sort of like youth workers have declined, and the youth workers that are sort of working are often spending up to sort of 60, 70% of their time trying to get small pots of money rather than doing their jobs. We've lost something like 4,500 youth workers. And when there is a public provision for teens, it is often, and this is actually sort of in, you can see it in statutory guidance, it is in the form of a play park, a skate park, a multi-use game area, or a kind of BMX track. And data by an organization who I do a lot of work with called Make Space for Girls has found that those spaces are 92% used by men and young boys. So what you're seeing is that 92% of the provision of for teens is used by the same percentage of young boys and men. And this is a sort of a failure of the Public Duty Act under the Equality Act in 2010. And a lot of what we advocate for is, whilst I think these are fantastic spaces because young people know that they're for them, the problem is that they're not used by a wide demographic. And so a lot of what we're doing is trying to design, get young people to design spaces for them beyond that very narrow subset of what kind of planning policy thinks is a teen space.
What is it that girls in particular lack, would you say? I mean, if you had a kind of, what is it in a park or a public space or a shopping precinct that needs to be there that isn't?
That's actually a more complex question than it would seem. When we talk about what does it lack, if you're imagining a green space, there is a kind of socio-cultural lack of entitlement to the provisions that you would typically find in a park. So although we have female skateboarders in this country, they feel, and you know, if you can find surveys, I don't know them off the top of my head, that they don't feel that those are spaces for them. But that kind of, let's say, challenge of entitlement to the existing provision is compounded by a fear of being in public. And this is where we have some pretty, I think, depressing statistics. The amount of women, and going, I do a lot of work with like year 9 girls, these are 13-year-olds, who feel sexualized in public space, becomes a huge barrier to their participating in public space. Women in general, I think the stats in London are like 74% of women feel unsafe when it's dark. And in December, that's 4 p.m. onwards. And so that perception of safety is perhaps the single biggest barrier. And then if you ask young women what would make them feel safer, it's actually just the presence of other people. And so this is where I get to kind of just designing good public realm, is that if you want young women to feel entitled to spaces, you need to design spaces that are accessible to them. And sometimes that might need going beyond the sort of sport provision to social spaces, seating, swings, but also design good public realms that there's other people around to make them feel safer.
Tina, back to you. You're hearing Julia, and I'm imagining you're kind of nodding furiously. I should explain to listeners that Tina's in Manchester and Julia's sitting in front of me in London. What do you make of that? I mean, are there parallels with the elderly or not? I mean, are there age-specific issues?
I think there's actually a lot of parallels in terms of older people and younger people being and feeling excluded often from the way spaces are being designed. And when Julia was talking about the importance of social infrastructure, so places that connect people and where people can feel a sense of belonging, those spaces that we have been losing during a decade of austerity, I think these places are so important also for people who want to age well in place in their own homes and communities. And there is this really interesting study by Eric Kleinenberg, and he looked at the 1995 Chicago heat wave, which killed 700 people, three quarters of whom were aged 65 and over. And what he found was that the difference between neighborhoods with high and low death rates often came down to social infrastructure. So in areas with cafes and parks and libraries, people knew each other, they checked out in crisis, this often saved lives. Whereas in places where those spaces had been lost, isolation actually proved deadly. So I think it's a powerful reminder that has also kind of showed again during the pandemic that such everyday places are hugely important, and they don't just bring people together in times of crisis, they can actually make the difference between life and death.
What you're both saying, and this is like kind of helicopter view from me, but if you kind of think about the architecture of a kind of a Roman town or a Italian city in the Renaissance, what was conspicuous about them, and actually why they're such pleasant places now, when you look at their when the infrastructure is still there, is that there's the famous Italian, Pagiato, a place to walk in the evening, kind of squares to gather in, fora, kind of civic space, places for interaction. And they're not just, outdoors, they're also kind of indoors. They're in basilica of churches. And it's all kind of less of it, or none at all. Am I talking nonsense, or do you think that resonates with you both?
Yeah, it definitely resonates with me. I feel that there is such a almost disdain for our kind of public, the sort of public infrastructure that stitches us together as a society. And you can see that there is a kind of also lack of funding around that too, which to me signals the lack of priority around it. And I often get asked, what role can design play? And I think how we design our cities is not just about the end product, it's the sort of method by which you get to somewhere. And often what I think, alongside sort of climate change and inequality, the distrust in local government distrust in government and institutions is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing, contemporary challenges that we're facing. And that becomes magnified when people feel that change happens at them and not with them. And so these processes, what we talk about, like community engagement, might sound fluffy, but actually they're really important mechanisms that connect citizens to decision makers. And when that doesn't work, it breeds huge amount of distrust. And so I think there's a really important reason why people, just in general, should be connected to the change that's happening around them and should happen with them. And that's a methodological point. If young people are consulted at all, which they're rarely not, it'll be in the form of a survey. And a survey is never going to give you that time and space to unpick or to delve beyond what you already know, which is why we often talk about our engagement practices is about a process of unlearning and learning new things. And that's a way to challenge this methodological question of how to engage people in the built environment.
And what was striking was you both cite this American sociologist, Sherry Arnstein, and her ladder of participation. A lot of what goes with participation is manipulation on the bottom rung of the ladder before you go eight rungs to full citizens' control. And although, both of you are kind of keen to involve young women, and Tina and the elderly, in actually how the social and physical infrastructure which surrounds them is designed and run, a lot of what passes for participation or kind of involving them is pretty thin, to say the least. Is that, Tina, I better bring you in because you have been sitting patiently up in Manchester. What's your view?
I very much enjoy, I think, using creative and participatory methods like the ones that Julia mentioned, it's about genuinely listening to people about what matters to them, building relationships of trust, and also allowing space for stories and ideas to unfold in very unexpected ways.
Can you put some flesh on it? Can you kind of make it live with an example that particularly lives in your memory?
So one example in our work in Manchester is a project that was aimed at working with older residents who live in low-income neighbourhoods, and we trained them to become co-researchers to investigate how we could make their areas more age-friendly. And the co-researchers were involved in different aspects of the research, so they decided what questions to ask and went on to interview 68 more socially isolated older residents about what their needs were to age well in the community. And one big issue that came up was the loss of the 86A bus service after public funding cuts. And this route had been a lifeline for getting people to shops, services, social activities. And without it, many people...
Tell us where the 86A went from and where to.
The bus line cut through the neighbourhood that was the core focus of the study at the time, Whalley Range, to the city centre of Manchester. And for many people, it was really a very important bus route because it was what kept them connected to their neighbours, to the social activities they were involved in. And based on this project, the co-researchers used some of the research findings and evidence to campaign to get the bus back. And after months and months of campaigning and working with different community organizations, they eventually succeeded in getting that bus service back. And then the community started to dub that 86A bus as the age-friendly bus. So that was a really interesting example of how we kind of worked with co-production methods.
Yeah.
Maybe I can give you an example of bad at the bottom of the ladder.
Okay.
So like typically, if I've gone through sort of various planning documents, and if you look at how, let's say, young people are engaged with, you'll get scant information, but you'll see that it's like, oh, we consulted with a group of young people, the number, I don't know how many, and they were asked whether they preferred option A, B, C, or D. Now, that is just seeking consensus for an already decided idea. And then so those young people would have picked A or B, whichever one. And we also will often not know how that, you know, the ethnic or age or gender demographic of that group. So all you're being told is that, you know, unknown number of young people approved option B the best. And that's really down at the bottom because there's no involvement. They've not shaped what that project is. They've not shaped where it is. And let's go up the ladder with a project that, well, actually, a project that started this method that I've been working on for many years now of paying and training young people to get involved in design and planning. This is a project that started out of COVID. And we were given a series of plots by a developer in Wembley Park called Quintain. And working with a group of young people, we designed various different public spaces in these different plots. And one of them it's a meanwhile space, so it's not permanent, but it's just as you approach Wembley Stadium on the right-hand side, there's this, what was a car parking space. And when we worked with the young people from kind of concept through to the actual delivery of the project, what they really wanted there was a space to just be, where you could go to the Sainsbury's, which was right next door, pick up a meal deal and just sit there and do nothing and not have a security guard or anyone move you away. And what really facilitated that space and why that was the best space for a place to just be was that it was very close to transport links. It was felt secure to this group of young people. And there was a toilet nearby in the library and the Sainsbury's, as I mentioned, to get your meal deal. And so that's an example of picking the right kind of project and putting it in the right space, and where we trained and worked with a group of young people throughout from concept through to build, which was a good 2.5 years.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. I was struck actually reading both your work, actually, that in 10 things that recur, one of them was access to toilets. I mean, it was a kind of concern. Tina, is that your... I'm not traducing your work, am I?
No, I think access to public toilets is an issue that comes up in many of the interviews and that we have with older people. And I think it's in London, there is actually a group, Lose for Kilburn. And it's a group of older people that has this long-standing campaign trying to advocate the restoration and the enhancement of access for public toilets along Kilburn High Road. And it's really an initiative that kind of brings to focus the importance of dignity, accessibility, but also public health. And it reflects a very strong example of how older adults are often advocates for issues that are important for older people, but actually for everyone in terms of being part of a neighbourhood.
Julian?
Well, I am happy to say I'm actually, well, obsessed with toilets. And this takes me back to I did a PhD by practice in India, which is where I grew up. That's where I actually cut my teeth in community consultation and engagement, was working with local NGOs to design and build low-cost, decentralised sewage systems. That's what I did for 10 years before starting to work with young people. And all the tools and methods that I use now, I really learned in those kind of contexts of quite poor, peripheral, working class communities on the edge of Delhi. And that was also, I think, what radicalized me, where if you see sanitation as just a kind of static pipe and not as social infrastructure, you're really missing the point. And so moving away from India and coming to the UK and again, recircling back to what Tina introduced with, which was the sort of loss of social infrastructure during austerity. And I mentioned that we've lost 50% of our youth hubs. We've also lost about 50% of our public toilets. And for young women and for girls, this has a major impact on how you can live your public life. And, you know, take a young woman who's got their period.
Yeah.
You know, that the inability to be able to deal with that, I hear it over and over again, means that you will just stay at home. Public toilets are not well maintained, they're dirty, and they're just not environments that young girls will want to be in. And it's become a kind of a culture war, which I'm not interested in discussing. But as a public provision, it's a really basic thing. And when we talk about why McDonald's is a successful space, one of the main reasons is that it's actually a kind of pretty clean toilet that you can go and use. And it's this basic public provisioning that I think we're getting so wrong. And if we think about the kind of heyday of the renaissance into our public lives, toilets was this sort of critical bit of infrastructure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, it's something I'm hugely passionate about.
I'm very struck by the privatizations of the 1980s and the cuts to local authority funding. One of the casualties was public toilets.
Yeah.
And let's talk about solutions, because we're getting to the... what is the answer? I mean, part of it is kind of to talk to folk, but I mean, it's resources. It's an exemplar in Britain of the kind of space that you'd like to see, both of you. I mean, Tina, what about Manchester, which is Mayor Andy Burnham has often looked to now as a place where some social pioneering is going on.
Yeah, so one important response to some of the challenges associated with aging in urban environments has come from the World Health Organization, who developed this age-friendly framework in the mid-2000s to help cities think about how they could support people to age well across areas like housing, transportation, outdoor spaces, participation, access to services. And this has now become a global movement with over 1,000 cities and communities that are part of this global network of age-friendly cities and communities. And Manchester was one of the first. We like to be pioneers, and has become internationally known for embedding age friendliness in its city and also its wider region strategies. And globally and also locally, I think the movement has achieved quite a lot. It has put aging on the agenda. I've been involved in a very recent report, Aging in the North, where it is shown that how you age is extremely deeply affected by your postcode and where you live. And the gap between the North and the South is extremely stark. So people, older people in the North have worse health, spend more years with illness and disability. They face higher rates of frailty, falls, hip fractures than those in the South. And poor housing is a major driver, something that is also a racialized issue. We know, for example, that over 35% of the Bangladeshi older people and over 29% of the Black African older population faces housing deprivation compared to just 4% of the white British population. And of course, this gap is hardly new. It results of decades of national policy, but it's something also that can be reversed and should be reversed. And I think some of those age-friendly policies and a more cross-government strategy to prevent unequal aging would be an important step forward.
Julia.
When we talk about solutions, for me, it's we've been talking a lot about good engagement, you know, good consultation. And often for us with young teens, that's about swings, better benches, you know, better lighting, really simple, basic things. You know, the amount of time we do some work with an organization called Light Follows Behavior, who try and, you know, who are a lighting company. And there was a woman who was raped in a park. And rather than increasing lighting and having difficult conversations about safety, they just shut the park. A local authority, that was their response. When we do good consultation, often the end results are really simple, basic things. And I get frustrated because I always hear, oh my God, there's no money. But actually the things that people who I'm working with want are actually much cheaper than the kind of typical public provision that I was discussing earlier. And then for me, that then right now, so my second point is around just policy, around making this stuff statutory requirements. Now, bats are quite famous because of the HS2 debacle. And why that's happened is that there's more planning legislation for bats and wildlife than there is for women and young people. There is actually no...
That's astounding. Really shocker.
You know? Yeah, and it's true. And so when we talk about, you know, if you're doing a big development like HS2, you've actually got to do bat surveys. At no point in any other kind of development do you have to do like women's safety surveys or talk to young people. And I think these are things that we should be mandating and mandating to do well. And so, you know, right now, the National Planning Policy Framework really has this kind of quite airy-fairy point around making safe, inclusive environments for everyone. But I don't know or have any sense of what that means or how one should get there. And so again, for me, this is a methodological question that needs to be mandated into policy to do good engagement, proper, good, well thought out, based on evidence, new evidence, and include people in it. And so then I guess to end would be like, I then get really inspired by places like Barcelona and then in Spain, but then you get a kickback of going, we don't have the climate for that. And this is why my favorite example that I use in the UK context is a city called, I say Umeå, but I'm pretty sure it's Umeå in Swedish. It's in the north of Sweden. And they decided to do this policy of gender mainstreaming throughout the city. So they put every single decision making through a kind of gendered lens. And the end result was that they fixed every single underpass in the city by adding lighting, adding exits, softening corners so you don't have blind spots. They changed bus stops. They co-designed play spaces and ended up with these incredible swing-type structures. And the end result today is that 97% of women feel safe during dark hours in this city. And I'd just like to remind that stat around 74% of women feel unsafe in London. And so I think a place like Umeå gives us an example of how we can move beyond this. and actually take things like women's safety and youth provision really seriously.
Tina, last word from you.
I am leading a cross-national study looking at how different cities that are committed to the age-friendly agenda are supporting people to age well in place. And we find that there is no perfect city, but there are pockets of good practice that we can learn from. For example, in Akita in North Japan, which has a population of nearly 40% already 60 and over, the city has joined the Global Network of Age-Friendly Cities in 2012, and the council really has invested in community-led projects that keep people connected, active, and also bring generations together. And one that I really loved was the Matagi Snipers, which is Japan's first professional esports team set up and run by older people. And the council provides a community space with computers, so people can learn digital skills, compete in gaming tournaments, but also importantly, connect with younger people. And one man told us that he really just wanted to make his grandchildren proud. And I thought it was a really brilliant example of how age-friendly spaces can open up unexpected ways to connect, learn, and participate across generations. But also other cities have strong participatory structures too. So in Bilbao, there is the Equipo Motor, a trained volunteer group of over 60s that works directly with the council and the mayor to influence policy. In Oslo, there is a citywide council of older people, which has its own budget and a formal role in decision making. So the key lesson across all these examples is the same. Bringing older residents into decision making can lead to urban environments that work better for everyone.
As I've grown older, you're so aware of an arc of a life, you know, and So you get to my age, you look back over the decades, and you kind of, it all builds to this, you know, and you have things to say about it, things to reflect, and actually kind of imparting that kind of to the young is I think quite an important responsibility of the old, actually. Anyway, look, great conversation. We've gone from saving the 86A bus, lose for Kilburn, and you've ended up, both of you, an optimistic note. We can do better, and we must do better. Build our social infrastructure. Let's get the best out of our cities and the best for young women and girls and the best for those of us who are aging, which is going to happen to all of us, by the way. So thank you both very much. And we'll round up and finish off another We Society podcast. And thanks for listening.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistle Down production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.